Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from July 13, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Yoganatha Sutta, a sutta on right meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becomingbuddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Let me put what I'm going to say in context. I know Rebecca's new to us, and Jane hasn't been here in a while, so just kind of a reminder. Siddhartha Gautama is the man who would become Buddha. He was born a king. He was born a prince in his father's kingdom in northern India. And there were many kingdoms. He wasn't the ruler of India. He was a ruler of a small area. But nevertheless, he had all the benefits of being a prince. And at the age of 29, he was very dissatisfied with his life, and he left the palace grounds for the first time and started wandering around the local town there. And he was shocked by the competitiveness and the aggressiveness of the people. For the first time in his life, he saw a sick man, a corpse, and he noticed some mendicants, people that were wandering around, living off other people's generosity. It shocked him and confused him, and he decided that he needed to leave the palace grounds in search of understanding the cause of all this competitiveness and the suffering that he saw around him. When he saw that corpse laying on the side of the road, the thought occurred to him how futile this life is if we're all going to end up that way. He had never confronted that before. And that's kind of the foundation for everything else that he would seek. So he spent the next 6 years of his life wandering around northern India, studying with some of the foremost spiritual teachers, learning their doctrines and their meditation practices, and he rejected them all as not leading to his goal. He didn't reject them as worthless, just didn't help him gaining understanding. He joined with five other mendicants, all seeking the same enlightenment, and they began practicing some very severe ascetic practices, so much so that it said that the Buddha could slow his breath to such a point where you thought he was dead. He lived on one grain of rice or one bean for a long, long time, and he became very emaciated. At the end of this period of asceticism, he was walking down the road one day and he passed out and he rolled down a little hill into the river and almost drowned. A young girl nursed him back to health, gave him some substantial food, and he got a little bit stronger. And the point I say all that is he practiced this asceticism, he practiced with teachers teaching the most so-called advanced spiritual practices, and he lived a life of luxury for many, many years. And he found all of those basically a distraction. None of them helped him gain an understanding. So he realized that the one extreme of continual sensory indulgence, getting everything he wanted and indulging in anything he desired, was not the way. And he also had developed that practice of asceticism, that continual denial of his own basic needs was not the way either. And he realized what he would later call a middle way between those extreme views. That's exactly what the middle way is. And that middle way was the Eightfold Path. So if you think about what he was seeking to understand, and when he finally awakened and developed that, the story is told that after he regained a little bit of his strength, he decided out of great frustration that I'm going to sit in meditation and I'm going to stay in meditation until I develop awakening, till I understand. And he did that. The legend is it took around 40 days. That process of wanting to understand the nature of human suffering and not knowing it is ignorance, isn't it? Ignorance means you don't know something. There's other components of ignorance, meaning an ignorant mind will usually ignore anything that it's ignorant of to maintain that ignorant state. That's another word for conditioned thinking or confirmation bias. It's also a good description of karma. Upon his awakening now, he understood the true nature, the truth of human life. He was no longer ignorant of it. So his description of his own awakening, which is the first time he described it, is in a sutta called the Nagara Sutta. He describes dependent origination, which states that from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, things that you can observe in yourself, all manner of suffering arises. Dukkha, the first noble truth, is there as dukkha. He describes dukkha as birth is dukkha, birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is desired, what you want, is suffering. And we all know that. It's frustrating. These are simple, obvious truths, aren't they? Getting what you don't want is suffering. It's stressful. It's true, isn't it? And then he would always conclude this. There's sometimes other components when he's describing suffering. But he would always conclude that broad statement by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. The five clinging aggregates are something I won't get into tonight. The five clinging aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness. But it's that consciousness that is thinking rooted in that initial ignorance. And these five components cling together, and we use that to describe ourselves. So when he's saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering, he's describing the personal experience that we all have from clinging these things together and to using those things to describe yourself. That also is pointing to the understanding that what we are describing to ourselves as a self is not a self. That refers to another Pali word, anatta, which means the not-self characteristic. We fooled ourselves into believing this is us when it's really not. And that's really the root cause of suffering. So upon his awakening, he taught Four Noble Truths for the very first time. I just described dukkha there as dukkha. Craving originates and clinging perpetuates dukkha. Craving for sensory experiences and an establishment of the self through the senses is craving. And then once that's established, clinging ourselves to that experience. The third noble truth says cessation of this process is possible. And the fourth noble truth is that the path leading to the cessation of our own contributions to stress is the Eightfold Path. That was the Buddha's very first teaching. The reason why I'm saying that tonight and to put everything into context is everything the Buddha would teach from that point forward was in that singular context of Four Noble Truths. And the reason why that's important, if you pick any sutta out and let it stand alone without any context, it's very hard to understand why he would even say something like this, let alone how does it fit into a strategy of awakening. But when you understand it in the proper context, it's all rather obvious. So this sutta tonight, the Yogananda Sutta, was actually taught by a monk named Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin and his chief attendant for the last 25 years of the Buddha's life. There's most of the suttas in the Pali Canon are direct teachings of the Buddha, but some of them, a handful, were from senior monks and nuns. And those are usually pretty famous suttas. This one is in particular. The eighth factor of the... Well, let me go back just a little bit. The Eightfold Path is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right meditation, and right mindfulness and right meditation. And I won't get into that explanation. All of this is on the website too, by the way, but Rebecca, in my books. The eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is right meditation, which implies that there's such a thing as wrong meditation. Perhaps a better word would be skillful meditation and unskillful, pointing to the fact that the Buddha only taught one type of meditation for a very singular purpose as part of this broader framework. And that's not to say that every other meditation is useless or foolish. It's just not in this context. So he taught meditation primarily for deepening concentration, developing a non-distracted mind, so that well-concentrated mind could support mindfulness of the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path, and they would comprise a complete path towards awakening, towards full human maturity. The underlying human experience that's common to everyone has three characteristics. The first is anicca, impermanence. Everything that we encounter and everything that we are is part of impermanence. There's nothing we can point to in the entire conditioned world, entire universe, that is permanent in any way, even though some things continue. Continuance often obscures impermanence. And because we're trying to establish a permanent self in that impermanent environment, we create stress. The next common characteristic is called anatta, the not-self characteristic. And that simply means that the views that we've created about ourselves are wrong views. They're rooted in ignorance. The Buddha is simply saying, let go of those views if you want to see reality clearly. And because of the misunderstanding of impermanence and not-self characteristics and their interplay, we create that third common characteristic, which is dukkha, ongoing stress in our lives. Every human being, the reason why they're called the three marks of existence, is every human being carries those marks. We all have those as part of our common human experience. And it's really the interplay and the distraction of getting caught up in this that is the problem. And that leads to, finally, to tonight's talk, the Yoganatha Sutta. The Yoganatha Sutta refers to the proper use of meditation, and the meditation method that the Buddha taught is called Shamatha Vipassana. Shamatha means to quiet the mind or to develop a tranquil mind. Vipassana means to gain insight. But it's a very specific insight into those three marks of existence. And there, this follows last week's talk, was on the three marks of existence. Which is, all these talks are on the website too, by the way, and you can listen to them if you're going to catch up. So, any questions about all that I just said as a kind of a long lead-in into tonight's talk? It's clear where I'm going, Rebecca?
Yeah, it reinforces some things that I've already learned too, so it's not completely alien.
Good. I mean, that really...
In terms of concepts, yeah.
That's the point. It's just so that what I'm saying is, at least you have a context for viewing it. Mm-hmm. Jane, you remember?
You set the stage really nicely.
Right, nice. Do you have any questions that I heard that I make you more confused? I hope not.
It's definitely, I don't feel like I'm so familiar with it, so I don't know as much of the background, but I feel a little distracted today, so I think it's just, I'm not feeling so focused, so.
It's an awful lot of information that I gave. I usually don't talk that much. Kevin, for example, I probably do. I try to draw a fine line between too much information, but also keeping in the context. But the reason why I have ongoing classes in three a week is to be able to present the entire context of it. So don't feel too confused.
Yeah, I love the review. The global view of it again, this is a great thing to hear.
I think I also need to be, studying up on my own too.
That's part of it. Yeah, it's not enough to just listen to one guy once or twice a week or occasionally. There is more. But do you have a copy of the book, The Truth of Happiness?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because it's in there, and then my new book is coming out. Should be out Monday. Which is even more comprehensive and develops it in a slightly different way. Again, I'm not trying to sell books tonight, but...
How much of the not-a-self is generated externally?
Pardon me?
Internally? How much of the not-a-self...
Oh, what a great question.
Externally versus internally?
I could answer yes to both.
Yeah.
And it really depends on your view. Initially... This thing called anatta, the not-self characteristic, mm-hmm. is rooted in ignorance. And because of that, it seeks to establish itself in every object, event, view, and idea that occurs to it. Mm-hmm. And that's called self-referential views. So every thought is a self-referential view, and there's an attachment of this view of self to that thought, including incredibly mundane objects. Like, I like... oak trees, I really don't care for cherry trees. But that's establishing itself in both trees. Mm-hmm. We see ourselves. That's clear. How we, and we do that with everything because we have this self-referential view.
Okay.
So those are externally focused views and external attachments. But the process is ongoing internally. Mm-hmm. And that's really where the problem is, because now we've created a veil between who we are and the establishment of ourselves outside of ourselves through all these different views. And in the Nagara Sutta, the Buddha even describes his own awakening as getting caught in the feedback loop of self-referential views and consciousness rooted in ignorance. And if you think about that, just another word of saying, another way of describing deluded views.
Mm-hmm.
How do a deluded person know that they're deluded? Because you don't have any context for recognizing the delusion, do you? That's the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, to provide a framework for recognizing and abandoning those self-referential views rooted in ignorance. So a very profound question, very important question. Initially, it's really the best to see that all of my views are externally focused and I'm creating an identity based on that. And as we start, meditation begins the process of bringing our views and our thoughts more inwardly focused and less distracted by attaching to external things. The reason why I say that the Buddha taught meditation for deepening concentration is precisely that. In meditation, I'm sure we all found this tonight. At some point, we were caught up in our thoughts again. And we had to remind ourselves and recognize that and come back to our breath as a point of focus. Getting caught up in your thoughts is getting caught up in self-referential thoughts. All of those thoughts were attachments to objects, events, views, and ideas that were distracting in the moment. Meditation interrupts that constant process of being outer-focused or stuck in our thoughts. And even if it's just for a brief moment and we're back up in our heads again, that's enough to begin the process of deepening concentration and interrupting that outwardly focused view. Ultimately, what we develop is a view that's free of any of those ignorance-based attachments, a mind that is completely at peace and at ease no matter what's occurring. And that doesn't mean that our life is completely free of stress. We cease reacting to it. We cease the need for anything to be different than this. Remember the Buddha's initial discussion of dukkha. Nobody can exchange birth, sickness, aging, death, not getting what they want, getting what they don't want. Nobody can. So why did it take an awakened human being to point that out? It's because we don't want to face it. We want to ignore that. That's that initial ignorance and the need to ignore anything that would challenge it. Meaning, I'm in control of my birth. I'm in control of my sickness. I'm in control of aging. I'm in control of death. I can get whatever I want, and I can keep anything I don't want out of my life. It's foolish, isn't it? But yet, most of us will spend our entire life exactly in that pursuit, holding on to things that we've acquired, even though we know they're permanent, creating stress in our minds over and worry and anxiety over getting things that we don't want, even though we're not in control of most of that. And also getting stuck in this five clinging aggregates of wanting ourselves to be different when we can't be. It doesn't mean we can't change, we can't grow. But in the moment, we can't be anything different than we are because that's who we are. In the moment, our lives can't be any different than they are because that's what's occurring. The only thing we can do, the only thing we're in real control over, is our own minds and ultimately how we either respond or react to life. And that's being in the process of awakening if we're developing an Eightfold Path. So that was another long talk based on that one simple question. I hope it's helpful. Again, to keep this in context. So the Yoganatha Sutta, it means tranquility and insight in tandem. The importance of incorporating both of these as part of the meditation practice. So this sutta, again, they're not often taught like this, but this was taught by Ananda. And he says, "Friends, whoever achieves the unbound state of awakening does so by the means of one of four paths," but you'll also notice he's really talking about one path. "When one has developed insight, preceded by tranquility," insight is vipassana, tranquility is shamatha, "their path is born. They followed the Eightfold Path and developed the path and pursued the path. As they develop the path, their shackles are abandoned." Shackles meaning we're letting go of attachments to wrong views, clinging views. "Their shackles are abandoned and their obsessions destroyed. They are unbound and awakened. When one has developed tranquility preceded by insight, their path is born. They follow that path, the Eightfold Path. They develop the path and pursue the path. As they develop the path, their shackles are abandoned and their obsessions destroyed. They are unbound, they are awakened. When one has developed tranquility in tandem with insight, their path is born. They follow that path, develop the path, and pursue the path. As they develop the Eightfold Path, their shackles are abandoned and their obsessions destroyed. They are unbound and awakened. When one's mind has its restlessness, doubt, and confusion well under control, their mind grows steady inwardly." It's tranquility. Restlessness is another word for reaction or constantly discriminating your thoughts. I like this, I don't like that. I need this, I need that. It's a restlessness. We've all been caught up in that. Our minds don't seem to calm because we're so stuck in the things that we think we need to continue to be happy rather than just develop calm and peace right now. When one's mind has its restlessness well under control, their mind grows steady inwardly and settles down. Their mind becomes unified and well concentrated, referring to meditation. As they develop the path, their shackles are abandoned and their obsessions, mainly an obsession with the self, are destroyed. They are unbound, they are awakened. Friends, whoever achieves the unbound state, meaning awakening, free of the bondage to sensory desires, does so by means of one of these four paths. But you can see that they're all the same path of shamatha and vipassana together in tandem. That's the point of the sutta. It's the point of meditation. That we need a method to quiet our minds so that we can gain, so resting in that concentration, that calm and peaceful mind, we're able to gain insight into the three marks of existence. The impermanence of all things, the nature of this not-self characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. Why is that so important? Well, that's the whole problem, isn't it? We know that we're in an impermanent environment, but we don't pay any attention to that. We want to ignore the fact that these things that we're attaching ourselves are all impermanent. Because if we didn't, we would have to let go of the notion that I can establish a permanent self in anything. And it's because of the stress caused by that misunderstanding, that lack of understanding, that ignorance, that dukkha arises, that stress arises, that disappointment. Dukkha means anything from mild disappointment, an unsatisfactory nature to life, to great emotional, mental, and physical suffering. That's all part of dukkha. And it's all part of human life, isn't it? When we learn to, through a well-concentrated mind, able to frame the Eightfold Path, we learn to see life clearly. Our minds remain calm and at peace. We accept things. A more emphatic way of saying it, we've developed radical acceptance of things as they are. Most importantly, we've developed radical acceptance of who we are in this moment. And we start with right now. The implication isn't that once we become awakened, then I can accept myself. Because what are you doing? You're just chasing a view, aren't you? And if you come to my classes, and I hope you continue, you hear me say this very often, we must be very gentle with ourselves. And what I mean is we must begin to let go of any judgments we have of ourselves right now. And that doesn't mean that we acknowledge or accept the fact that we're not awakened yet, but we don't disapprove of it. One of the things that develops rather quickly within the framework of the Eightfold Path is we gain the ability to see the difference between acceptance and approval. Most of us have those things tied together. In order for me to accept something, I have to also approve of it. That's two different qualities of mind. So we can approve or disapprove of something. That really doesn't matter, but we accept it because it's simply what's occurring. Beginning with ourselves, we might recognize that we're not completely in accordance with the Eightfold Path, but we accept it because that's who we are and because we want to go further. If we start judging ourselves harshly in any way, I'm not meditating long enough or hard enough or whatever it is, I'm not engaged in right speech, right action, right livelihood enough, I'm an awful person, I'll never get it, you never will get it. But if you can learn that radical acceptance of who you are right in this present moment, for no other reason except that's what's occurring, it's just logical sense, isn't it? Then you can progress, then you can stay within the framework of the Eightfold Path. The last two Tuesdays I've been giving a talk on the Eightfold Path and breaking it up into the wisdom factors, right view and right intention, the virtuous factors, right speech, right action, right livelihood, and next Tuesday's talk will be on the concentration factors of right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. The reason why I say that is that the virtuous factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood, when we're mindful of them, we immediately recognize where we're continuing to trying to establish a self. It's called eye-making. Where we're contributing to the stress in our lives and contributing to the ignorance. Once we recognize that and start to abandon those types of views, we're now inclining our minds towards awakening. And that points to the potential of each moment and the reason why gentleness is so important. If in the moment we can be free of judgments of ourselves and others and what's occurring, then our minds can continue towards awakening. We're no longer distracted. If we continue with minds rooted in ignorance, we can only become more ignorant. So that really points to the potential of each moment. We can continue to become more ignorant, or we can continue to become awakened on that unmanned state. So that's enough on tonight's talk, I think. We covered a lot of information tonight. We'll go around the room in just a second, but are there any specific questions on what I just said? No? Okay, ladies first. Rebecca, it's good to have you tonight. How was your meditation, and do you have any general questions?
Meditation was good. I went into the state that I kind of expect or try for pretty quickly, which was good. A little distracted by some physical stuff, but that was it.
Yeah, good. I usually have a booklet that has this meditation method described, and I don't have it out here. But on the website, crossovermeditation.com, on the top menu, you'll see guided meditations, and there's a guided Shamatha Vipassana meditation and instructions on that page. If you're just reinvigorating a practice, don't try to meditate for too long. Whatever you're comfortable with is fine. But if that's just 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, that's enough to get your practice going again. And if you can do that twice a day, that's the most effective way to establish a meditation practice. And then hopefully you continue to join us here.
Anything feels peaceful without a
3-year-old. There's years of articles and talks on the website about the broader framework. A little yellow card that has our schedule on that and the website address that you can take. You can also sign up for the newsletter that I send out twice a week, too. So, yeah. Welcome to our Sangha. Jane, good to see you again tonight.
Nice to see you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you.
I felt, distracted at times, but also relaxed. And so it's just kind of a dance between the breath and noticing the breath and then kind of going back to my thoughts and, the same old.
Yeah.
But I really like what you say also about radical acceptance. I think I'm going to use that as my mantra.
That's a good one.
it was nice. I felt relaxed,
good.
Even despite feeling a lot of pain. Like in my back and some distracting thoughts, I felt relaxed.
It's just that way. The reason why we need a meditation practice is because we're distracted.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. That's usually what stops people from meditating. As they say, they just can't get past that distraction. Every time you recognize you're caught up in your thoughts and come back to your breath, even if it's just for a brief moment, you're deepening your concentration. So it's easy to get frustrated by the distractions or even the physical pain. Remember that during meditation, this is the time that we meditate. That's all. And anything that occurs is fine. Come back to the sensation of breathing. And then, it's part of that broader framework. But I'm so glad you joined us tonight.
I realize I need to, after every time I meditate or come here, I realize the importance of doing it,
yeah.
Meditating. And then... Yeah, it is. It's important to keep it up as a habit.
No, it is. The benefits are from a consistent practice. But again, when you find that you've missed a session or missed a couple of days, don't judge yourself. Just realize the benefits of it. The proper motivation comes from within, But the support, there's great support that comes from being part of a sitting group.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I've ever had a student that didn't say basically the same things. There's so many distractions in life. Sometimes we create it. But being part of a regular sitting group just reinforces that. Even if it's if you come regularly on a Thursday night and Sunday afternoon comes by and you don't feel like meditating, you remember, I'll be there Thursday, so I'll meditate today too. It just helps reinforce the practice in a practical way. And then the development of the Eightfold Path is a mutually supported practice. In other words, it supports a meditation practice, and meditation supports the other factors. So very, very difficult to establish and maintain whatever the meditation method is, just meditation. And it can often lead to its own kind of difficulties. So. OK, Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, Tom. Thank you. Talk is very, as usual, just very fundamental, really. Yeah. You know, and I think that's the first time I ever heard a talk just directly addressing Vipassana meditation from, you know, Buddha or from Ananda. My practice has been consistent, and, you know, it's consistently inconsistent, but just like everyone else, there are moments of distraction, and there are moments of deepening concentration. So it's been very good. Today we had, I just said the thing, I don't know, but we had the most dukkha-inducing day because we were shopping for a used car. It just represents every bit of dukkha and every bit of hindrance in your life is all boiled down. It's the opposite of what we do here.
You're touching on somebody else's karma at the same time.
But by the same token, because of the practice, I found it was a different experience for me today than it has been in the past. Sometimes I just feel so distracted and so hopeless or so adversarial or so, you know, and it's all, you go through all these emotions and you do it, but I was able to, you know, even have kind of the compassion for the person who was selling me the car, or trying to sell me the car. I didn't buy a car, but it has everything about it. It's the dog. But the Dharma helps you. It's something we have to do because it's just part of where we are in our life right now. So it's something that the Dharma will help us.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. So you are clearly describing dukkha. It's just buying a used car is part of life, and it is suffering. It just is. It can't be any different. It immediately starts with impermanence. What year is it? You know, that's the first question. You're referring to impermanence. And you can't help but see yourself in the car, and the car is you, and it probably is. You know, I bet you the Buddha would have used that in 26, if there was such a thing as cars. Dukkha is buying a used car.
Yeah, and it's just all about your attachment. There's the attachment to your own money, thinking I have a car with money at this, and it's going to happen.
Yeah,
and am I throwing it away? Is this a trick? You know, it's just the whole.
What's this car?
It's sort of a metaphor for everything that is not.
It is, and it's an inescapable part for almost everyone. It's an inescapable part of life. You have to buy a car, and it is just about everything else you do. Is in some way related in that way. You know, there's stress arising because of the self-identity, because of the impermanence, because of everything around it.
The biggest impediment to my pursuing awakening is the fact that, you know, most of the people that I interact with aren't.
Well, that's a good point, and that's another reason why we need a well-concentrated mind and to not self-identify with other people. And we let other people be
radical acceptance.
It's radical acceptance. We don't have to approve of anyone, but we learn to accept everyone, no matter. And this, you take this to an extreme, because it doesn't matter how egregious someone else's behavior is. We don't have to approve of it. We don't have to disapprove of it. We accept it simply because it's what's occurring.
And if
you fight it gets worse, and there's nothing you can do. Think about the most awful person you can think of, and unfortunately we have plenty of them. At the time, they were doing the best they could as far as their level of understanding was. They thought they were right in what they were doing, no matter how awful they were. And all of that awful behavior grew out of ignorance. Everybody acts because they think they're right. If they're acting because they think they're right and they're acting in such an awful way, they're ignoring something, aren't they? It's ignorance. The Buddha recognized it. The world was just as violent and just as crazy 2,600 years ago as it is today. But that when you understand the description of dukkha and the cause of dukkha, it really explains all human ills. And it also is the answer to bringing it to cessation. I don't know if that'll ever happen. Well, great class. Any other questions or comments about tonight's class? A quick reminder, Rebecca, you're invited. Our Sangha picnic is this Saturday. Rain date is Sunday. It's just across the bridge, about 10 minutes from here. There's info on the website. If you have any trouble finding it, just send me an email. But and everybody, your daughter's welcome, and friends or anybody else. And Jane, you too. Please join us. And if you got any friends you want to bring. There was another announcement. I did announce it. The new book is finished. The Kindle version should be available. It's called Becoming Buddha. Mm-hmm. And it is...
of course, if you meet him on the road, kill him.
not from my point of view. It really develops the entire Buddhist teaching. Mm-hmm. Kind of a long book, but very easily understood. And it shows how we get caught up in the impermanence, this wrong view of self, and how we create suffering. But most importantly, how to recognize it and bring it to an end. The paperback should be available Monday. Kindle should be available Saturday or Sunday. It's just the process of Amazon.
That's
exciting. Yeah, and yeah, thank you. The first book that I wrote along these lines, The Truth of Happiness, is a 10-week course developing this understanding. I published that first just because Becoming Buddha, I knew it was going to take me much longer, but I wanted to get that out there. So. I think that's the only other one.
How long has it been in the works?
I'm 61, so about 61 years.
Mm-hmm.
You're born in the eye.
Two years ago or so, and then the writing began about 2 years ago, but the formation of the book kind of coalesced at last year's retreat, and then... Mm-hmm. Really became fine-tuned at this year's retreat based on the questions. I thought the book was done, and then the questions that came up at our spring retreat, I realized that there was a little bit more information, and that was true. You know, it was. As a teacher, it's one thing to know something; it's another thing to know that you taught it well. And I realized on the retreat, it wasn't that I didn't teach it well, but I didn't teach it enough. There wasn't enough background or context, and that. So that's what's in the book. All right, we finish every class with metta meditation. Metta means goodwill or loving kindness. And we first express that to ourselves and then to all sentient beings. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And as I said, metta is both an expression of an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.